Hi, this is Willie Nelson from Normal. For 30 years, Normal has provided a voice for the millions of Americans who smoke marijuana responsibly. More than 500,000 Americans are arrested each year for smoking pot. These are ordinary citizens like you and me whose lives and careers are being needlessly destroyed. To learn how you can help, contact Normal at www.norml.org or call toll-free at 888-67-NORML.
And distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to the Audio Stash. Today, I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal to end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit norml.org. Random drug testing in the workplace and schools has become a part of American society, even as serious questions remain as to their effectiveness and role. Joining us today to talk about these trends and technologies is Jenny Kern of the Drug Policy Alliance. She's the campaign coordinator of the Drug Testing Fails campaign. Jenny, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
Oh, well, thank you so much for inviting me to be here.
Jenny, Paul Armentano, Normal Senior Policy Analyst, recently mentioned that you attended a conference and expo of the companies that perform drug testing. Tell us a little bit about that conference and the companies that were there.
Well, it was an industry-wide conference, so it was all the movers and shakers in the drug testing industry. One particular company I recognized was there, had presented at all of the Office of National Drug Control Policy conferences on student drug testing, and that was Southwest Laboratories. So it kind of, there was an overlay between the push for student drug testing by the industry, and it was kind of an internal industry conference. So Paul had recommended it to me. I followed up to learn more about drug testing more generally after working on student drug testing so much. But also, it really is an industry conference, so that you'll get a lot of really frank information about the limitations of the technology and kind of what are the marketing strategies or where they're trying to go next.
This is slightly humorous for me to imagine, all the drug testing companies in a modern expo with booths and everything. How do these companies exhibit their wares?
Well, there are, you know, there's a lot of free samples of drug tests, and they do. They set up all the booths, and they'll tell you all about all the various different devices from, you know, oral fluid testing and urine testing and you know, hair testing, and so they're all set up there, and you know, it's kind of a, you know, it's a show. And but if you go up and ask, you know, the presenters, they'll be really frank with you about the limitations of technology. So for instance, oral fluid testing, which they're using in some schools, drug testing has a really short window of detection. So for instance, marijuana, the window of detection is only about 4 to 8 hours, perhaps even less, maybe even 1 to 2 hours, I've heard. So And it only detects for the mostly for the metabolites and not the parent drug of marijuana. So it's not very sensitive at all. So in a lot of schools that are conducting random drug testing, they'll say, oh, you know, we haven't had positive results. This is such a success. Whereas really it's just a false sense of security because they're really not picking up on what's going on with this kind of technology. So that's just one example.
You mentioned the marketing a moment ago. How do these companies market themselves and grow their business?
When the Supreme Court decision came down, unfortunately, allowing these policies of random student drug testing, the drug testing industry was all abuzz. They saw it as a new niche market. And they really, you know, a lot of when proposals are proposed at school boards, often drug testing companies will volunteer and come in and tell them how their technology is 100% accurate and, you know, they'll never have false positives, which isn't true. The technology is actually fairly limited, especially when you're doing kind of point of collection tests, which are, you know, the dipstick tests that they do in initial screens in schools. And those tests are very shaky. And then they'll have to do follow-up tests. So what they really do push very hard. They have a lobby branch in Washington that's trying to push the expansion of drug testing. So they're really active, and it's big money, big business.
Jenny, let's talk about the technology a bit here and start with the most common drug screening method. How is the modern test done, and is it accurate?
I would say it's probably that we probably know the most about your analysis compared to the other technologies because it's the one that's been around the longest. But you can't really make any broad sweeping statements about it because every drug testing company, you know, has different protocols. And one thing I learned at this industry conference is that it's a highly unregulated industry. So there are some laboratories that are SAMHSA certified, so that's for federal workplace drug testing, but there's only 48 of them in the whole country, so not even one per state. And they have probably the highest regulations and safeguards. But a lot of drug testing companies have no regulation or oversight whatsoever. And these are companies that, you know, review drug tests that go to that where the results will determine, you know, parental rights in courts or student drug testing. There's no required oversight whatsoever. So just in casual conversation over lunch with a drug tester who was just trying to learn more, she was telling me that her company was trying to save money, so they really try to be very sparing with the confirmation test. She said that a lot of the people administering the test don't know what they're doing, and also that she was in one situation where she demanded that they do a follow-up confirmation test, and if she hadn't demanded that, this woman would have lost her parental rights. And so there was some, you know, really frank discussion about, you know, the lack of regulation in the industry and kind of these horror stories that can come out of it. So it's kind of a scary issue.
Also growing in use is the hair testing technology, but we've heard about the wide inaccuracies, especially with darker hair color.
Yeah, that's true. We were involved in some conversations about a suit that's going on in Boston where African-American police officers were fired due to hair tests. And the science out there is fairly strong that people with darker colored hair, and of course it follows a lot of the racial biases, unfortunately, that are in our country, will retain the traces of drugs or the metabolites in the hair, whereas people with lighter colored hair, you know, blonde or lighter colored hair, will not. So it follows that African Americans are more likely to test positive than Caucasians, just due to the internal biases in the testing technology. And in fact, at this conference, they said that, you know, if you have gray hair, you know, they can't detect any drugs at all. So that was just kind of interesting.
It's certainly ironic when it comes to hair testing. People tout it as being less invasive, and it may seem so on the surface, But the results of hair tests look much further back into your personal history.
That's true. It's about a 90-day window, and it won't give recent use. So it's longer term, but it won't give recent use. And it is also one of these technologies that hasn't been approved for federal workplace testing. So there are guidelines underway to try to approve this, but it hasn't been approved. So it really is kind of one of these technologies that isn't very well regulated. We don't really know exactly what's going on there. So it really hasn't passed that test yet.
Jenny, let's talk about these home testing kits being marketed to parents. First, what's the most common type being sold out there?
Probably a urine test. I don't really know the brand names. But there has been a big push for these testing kits, and this is a great example of kind of the industry pushing for new markets. What has happened in some schools is, drug testing industries will go to the schools and say, you know, this is a great technology, parents can use it at home. So there's been a real push at school, and then also on behalf of the companies marketing to parents saying, you know, this is the answer, this will tell you whether, you know, your child is experimenting or using drugs. There has been research done on these companies that are promoting it. One such study was done at Children's Hospital Boston, and it reviewed internet-based home drug testing products for parents. So they were marketing towards parents. And they found that the companies didn't adequately educate parents about the limitations of drug tests and the technical challenges of administering the drug test themselves. So this includes the parents going through collection procedures. There's also the potential for misinterpreting results. There's also false positives and false negatives. And also, none of the sites go into any of the potential negative consequences on the parent-child relationship and some real damage that can be done there.
That parental relationship issue certainly is real when you have to ask your teenager to supply a urine sample. So let's assume a parent follows all the procedures for a home drug test. How accurate are they?
Well, a lot of the tests, they are not all to send in, and that's scary in itself. So a lot of them are just those initial point of collection tests, which are not very accurate at all. If you do, you know, send it into a laboratory, it will depend on, you know, if you did everything right and what the standards of the laboratory are. And also for interpreting those results, I don't know what kind of resources are available for parents in terms of if the child's on prescription medications, if they're eating certain food products. There's a whole myriad of ways to go wrong here. And the obtaining the collection procedures, you know, aren't that easy. If you're doing your analysis, the best standards are to shut off all water in the area, put blue dye in the toilet, and then to actually visibly see, oversee the collection of the urine to make sure that adulterants or other, other attempts to cheat the test. But when it's a parent-child relationship, that can be really damaging to that relationship, and that might not be appropriate at all. So there's a lot that can go wrong there, and there's even more that can go wrong in the interpretation process.
Now, Jenny, let's talk about the overall here. Is random student drug testing at schools or parent-administered drug testing in the home, is this deterring young people from using drugs?
Well, the best science available out there says it's not effective. The only national federally funded study to date surveyed 94,000 students in 900 American schools with and without drug testing programs, and they found no difference in illegal drug use among students from both sets of schools. So the research out there does not support testing whatsoever. Based on anecdotal evidence, there's a lot of schools that have dropped drug testing programs because they saw that, for instance, they had the largest problem with alcohol use. And student drug testing does not address alcohol, which is the most dangerous and most commonly used substance among young people. Alcohol leaves your system so quickly, about metabolized at about a drink per hour. that this whole random testing process really isn't gonna detect anyone unless, you know, they're drinking at school, which sometimes unfortunately does happen, but you would hope, you know, that teachers would be aware enough to pick up on that without needing a drug test.
So one final question for you today, Jenny. If you're a parent and your school has or is planning to implement random student drug testing and you don't like it, what should you do?
We have developed a website as a resource to parents to try to be really active, go to your school board meetings, write to the school, organize with other parents. And our website is www.drugtestingfails.org. And we put together a booklet with all the available arguments and research out there. And there is a whole slew of actionable items on the website. And it really, parents just need to get involved, be vocal. A lot of parents are just, you know, afraid to speak up. But it really is a very salient issue. It really goes to the heart of kind of your freedoms and, you know, what kind of society we're going to raise our children in. And there's a lot of public health experts who strongly oppose random drug testing too. So the efficacy, it just doesn't work. And then in terms of a public health issue, it really doesn't help.
Jenny Kern is coordinator for the Drug Policy Alliance Drug Testing Fails campaign. Jenny, thanks for joining us here today on Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Thank you so much, Chris.
We have links to the Drug Testing Fails website and more information on drug testing from Normal at normalaudiostash.com.
And sure enough, in the morning, some strange things began to happen in Willie's home. But outdoors, strange things were happening too.
If I were to tell you that in America, right now, according to U.S. government surveys, there are over 1 million children selling marijuana, what would you think? Would you think that any public policy that creates over 1 million teenage marijuana dealers needs to be re-examined and possibly amended? You would not be alone. The members of the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, otherwise known as NORML, have been working since 1970 to reform marijuana laws such that responsible adults, not children, sell and use marijuana. Isn't it high time to reform America's misguided marijuana laws? This is Alan St. Pierre, Executive Director of NORML in Washington, D.C. Only concerned citizens can effectively end the federal government's nearly 70-year-old prohibition on responsible adult marijuana sales and use. Want to know more about how you can help? Contact us at NORML, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, N-O-R-M-L, or by visiting the organization's popular and informative webpage at Normal, NORML.org.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Jack Cole is a 26-year veteran of the New Jersey State Police and served as an undercover narcotics officer for 14 years. Jack witnessed the drug war in America from every angle and went on to help found LEAP, Law Enforcement Against Prohibition. We'll be featuring a number of LEAP members in the Audio Stash in the future. LEAP speakers often travel to speak at Normal chapter meetings and events. Today, we'll speak with Mr. Cole about his personal experience and the role of LEAP. We have links to Law Enforcement Against Prohibition at normalaudiostash.com. Jack, welcome to the Audio Stash today.
Thanks for the invitation. Glad to be here.
Wonderful to speak with you today, Jack. Let's talk about LEAP. First, how and when did Law Enforcement Against Prohibition begin?
Well, we started it in 2002. When we started it, we had 5 founding members, all of us former cops. And in those 4 short years, we've grown to almost 6,000 members today. And we're not just cops anymore. We're cops, judges, prosecutors, prison wardens, even DEA and FBI agents. And we're all calling for an end to drug prohibition.
Jack, you served on the New Jersey State Police in the Narcotics Division. What brought you to the point where you were against prohibition?
Well, I actually did that for 14 of my 26-year career in the New Jersey State Police. And after just 3 years of working out undercover, actually living with those folks on the street, I discovered that I had been lied to a lot in my training, because we were trained to go to war against an enemy that was supposed to be the vilest enemy on the earth, people that would just as soon kill you as look at you. And after 3 years out on the street living with those folks, it suddenly occurred to me that I liked a lot of the people I was working on better than some of the people I was working for. The only difference between them and me was they wanted to put something in their body that I didn't want to put in mine.
And with over 5,000 members, LEAP now is a very strong endorsement of legalization. What's the common factor that brings law enforcement personnel into LEAP?
The common factor is that we fought this war for 36 years. It's the longest war in the history of the United States. And over that time, we've spent over $1 trillion on this war. All we have to show for it is that each year we arrest another 1,800,000 people in this country for nonviolent drug offenses, and we imprison as many as we can. We have 2.2 million people in prisons in this country now, about seven times as many as any country in, for instance, Europe imprisons per capita. And despite all this money so ill spent, all these lives pretty much destroyed that we arrest and imprison, today, drugs are cheaper, they're more potent, and they're far easier for our kids to get than they were in 1970 at the beginning of the war when I started buying them undercover. Now, that's a failed policy, and everybody in law enforcement realizes that.
And Jack, how are you trained to treat marijuana smokers as a law enforcement officer?
When I started at the beginning of the war, and that was back in the Reefer Madness days, even worse than it is today, although you look at our drug czar today and he's trying to say that marijuana is the worst drug in the United States. Back then, we were trained literally to go to war against these people. From what I had heard from them, I would have almost imagined before I went out there that these folks had horns growing out of their heads, you know. I thought they were almost demonic. And the truth is, of course, they're just us. And when I say that, according to DEA, before we started the war on drugs, they said that about 4 million people in this country had used an illegal drug. And by the year 2001, DEA was saying 110 million people have used an illegal drug in this country. That means that's most of the adults in this country. So this is not a war on drugs. This is a war on people, and it's virtually a war on us. It's a war on our kids. It's a war on our parents. It's a war on ourselves.
Jack, you speak to audiences around America and around the world. I have to wonder, you know, what do other cops say when you're in their town?
Well, the cops are very respectful to all of us. We have a number of speakers. We have well over 100 speakers. We've given over 2,200 presentations already in the last 3 years since we created our Speakers Bureau. And I've personally actually given more than 500 of those talks myself all around the world. And no matter where we go, our reception is the same. We don't usually talk to people who would be on our side. We think it's a waste of our time. We go out and we speak to civic groups, professional groups, religious and educational organizations, but mainly civic groups, things like Rotaries, Gowanus Clubs, Lions Clubs, Chambers of Commerce, Chapters of Military Officers of America. These are very conservative organizations. And we are sure that about 80% of those audiences agree with what we say after 30 minute to an hour talk. So, but you were asking specifically about police. Let me tell you, we started talking to police officers 2 years ago when we've been to now 18 national and international police conferences, law enforcement conferences, judges, corrections, police officers, DEA, FBI agents. We set up a educational booth there at their conference. It's there for the whole conference, and we staff it with a number of our speakers. And we keep very intricate track of how these folks feel after we talk to them on a one-to-one basis. And we're very aggressive. We don't sit behind our tables and wait for people to come to us because we figure, again, that way we'd only get the people that agree with us. We stand out in the aisles, and anyone that comes down that aisle, we got them by the elbow saying, hey, you heard about law enforcement against prohibition? We're cops, too. Can we talk to you for a minute about the war on drugs? Less than 1% of them refuse to talk to us. And out of all the ones that do talk to us, after we're through talking, we write down, did they agree, disagree, or were they undecided at the end? And we found that consistently, only 6% want to continue the war on drugs after they speak to us, 14% are undecided, and an astounding 80% agree with us. And the most interesting thing about that 80% is until we came along, there's just a tiny handful of those folks that ever realized that anyone else in law enforcement felt the way they do. These folks are so concerned about being labeled soft on drugs, soft on crime, that they're afraid to even talk to each other about what they really believe.
And so often I hear about these moments of epiphany, like Norm Stamper talks about this realization he had as a beat cop. But what is it that makes officers stay silent about their daily experience?
If you really came out, for instance, it was 1973 when I decided, after 3 years undercover, that the only way we could do anything to lower the incidence of addiction to drugs in this country would be to legalize them and regulate them and keep them out of the hands of our children. But I didn't tell anybody that in my organization because I knew if I did, I might not have been fired, but I certainly wouldn't have got promoted. You know, I certainly wouldn't have been on the move up. Certainly the people who were in those jobs want to move ahead just like people in any other jobs.
So you and LEAP are breaking this taboo. It must take a lot of courage to bring this LEAP message into FBI and DEA conventions and conferences.
Well, at first, we felt like maybe it would take some courage, but it really doesn't at all. I have never had anybody disrespect me or, you know, get personal about my views. I've had a number of them that don't agree with me, but they were always just as respectful as could be. And well, they should be, because I spent 26 years of my life putting my life on the line, just as they did, to try to stop drug abuse in this country. And I and the other 6,000 people at LEAP haven't changed our minds about that at all. What we've changed our minds about is that a war on drugs is not the way to go about it. The way to go about it is to end drug prohibition, just like we ended alcohol prohibition in 1933, because as law enforcers, we know that when we ended that terrible law, the next morning, Al Capone and all these smuggling buddies were out of business. They were off the streets. They were out of a job. That meant they weren't out there killing each other to control the market. They weren't killing cops charged with fighting that useless war. And they weren't killing kids caught in crossfire. All the things that happen today under the new drug prohibition. So if we ended prohibition, we could, one, save a lot of lives from violent crimes that wouldn't be committed. Two, nobody would have to die from overdose deaths. No one dies, by the way, from an overdose because they shoot more and more dope to get higher and higher. They die because they don't know how much of that powder they're buying is really the drug and how much is the cutting agent. Too much drug, you're dead. It's like Russian roulette without a gun. Three, we could prevent 50% of all the new cases of AIDS and hepatitis that will occur in this country this year and next year and every year afterwards, because the Center for Disease Control says that's how many cases can be traced directly back to drug users sharing needles. And four, we could lower the number of people abusing drugs and addicted to drugs considerably if we legalized the drugs and regulated them. And we know that this works because the place that came closest to it is Switzerland, and after a 10-year period of them giving free government heroin to heroin users in that country, they have had an 82% reduction in the expected cases of new heroin users. That means the kids aren't picking it up. They're not using it. And they're not using it because it's being given away free in clinics, so there's no drug dealers on the streets to sell the drugs, which means they're not going to kill each other, cops or kids, and they're not in the neighborhoods to entice young novices to pick up that deadly drug. We would just be so much better off with legalization.
Jack, this has been a wonderful discussion today. Thanks for joining us here on the Audio Stash, and I look forward to speaking with you again very soon.
Thank you very much for the invite. Bye.
Jack Cole is the Executive Director of Law Enforcement Against Prohibition and a former New Jersey State Police narcotics officer. We have links to leave at normalaudiostash.com. You've been listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.